Good evening. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Watching China's economy, the expectation is that it is recovering, that the decline, gradual decline of its GDP estimates reflect worldwide slowdown, but the new normal will not take China down any farther, and that the growth of the planet is focused in East Asia, in the massive appetite China has for natural resources, for investment, and for consumer goods. Gordon Chang of Forbes.com is here with me because we're going to talk about a couple of instruments that show that China's economy is not stable, but that it's trying to deal with, oh, I don't know, putting fingers in the dikes every once in a while when it springs a leak, but that didn't work out that well in Europe, so maybe it won't work in China as well. Gordon, what is a China trust, a trust loan? For example, the $500 million trust loan originated by China Credit Trust Company.
John, this is a shadow banking product where you have the state banks not being able to make and not wanting to make certain loans because of various reasons. And so what has occurred is that essentially a trust company has stepped in, borrows or takes money from a bank, usually in the form of investments or bank customers, and then lends it out to pretty dodgy customers. There's been a number of coal companies that have been really the beneficiaries of getting money from these trust companies. And now they've started to default or threaten to default. And that is starting to shake the Chinese banking system.
The question is raised in this article I'm reading from Barron's. How shaky is it? Are the trusts reliable? Are they high risk? Do they pose a systemic risk? And again, when you're on the investor side, usually unlikely, which is not what I'd call a good answer. There are a lot of things that are unlikely. For example, you're unlikely to get into a traffic accident. You still take precautions. So what are we looking at here? Systemic risk or a couple of rich people losing a lot of money?
Well, it could be both. And the reason is that if investors are not willing to fund a lot of these companies, which they do indirectly, then you could have defaults of these companies, which then could just ripple through the economy. That's the concern. See, investors go into the shadow banking products offered by the trust because they get returns that are 3, 4, 5, 6 times what they can get at a state bank. Because at the state bank, deposit rates are limited by the central government. So essentially what you have are very low-yielding deposits, which are very unattractive, especially because of high inflation in the society. You have negative interest rates in many cases. But if you go into these shadow banking products, you can make, instead of 2 or 3%, you can make 10%. So they're very attractive.
Why did they invent these, Gordon? What about the Chinese banking system that requires this kind of risk-taking, but also what you'd have to say is an insider's game?
Well, essentially, there are a couple things going on. These invented because these make economic sense, because a lot of the borrowers who have taken – essentially these trusts, they take money from investors who come from the state banks, and essentially then these trusts lend money to coal companies and others. Well, these companies do need money, and they weren't being serviced by the state banking system. So economic reality somehow said this has got to happen. We've got to get capital into the hands of private companies, even if they're not the most creditworthy in society. And then, of course, on the other side, which you just talked about, it was economically necessary to give holders of capital decent returns, which they weren't getting in the state bank system.
This strikes me as very far from the idea of a command economy. This looks like a kind of frontier capitalism.
It is frontier capitalism. It shouldn't occur because if you look at the way this Chinese command or semi-command economy operates, it's just that this wouldn't exist. But authorities have allowed it to exist because if they didn't, the economy would fall apart. So economic reality is dictating that all of these workarounds are actually blessed by officials, if officially or unofficially.
Are we learning that the Chinese frontier capitalism is flexible, is adjusting to mistakes, for example, the flooding of the markets with cash? Is this a way of recovering from that?
Well, this is an adjustment, but it's also creating risk because what's happened is it's allowed capital to go to some pretty unsavory borrowers who are not in a position to pay back money. They're paying back money. It's like 10, 15%, and they cannot do that. And so the problem here is that the central government doesn't want them to default, so it's sort of helping them out. But by helping them out, it tells everybody in the market there's no risk. And if there's no risk, then you have misallocation of capital. And that's exactly what's happened in China since the end of 2008.
Full stop. Risk, however. Gordon and I, for more than a year now, have been watching the East China Sea, the Senkaku Islands, and the South China Sea. I was disappointed to learn that the United States Navy and the Obama administration has not been treating with alarm or concern the aggression that we've documented by the PLA Navy. And then, all of a sudden, I come across a YouTube, which may be out of date, but it features a speaker, head of Naval Intelligence in the Pacific, and PACCOM, the Pacific Fleet. His name is Fennell. And a year ago, he made statements which identified China as an aggressor state, as a predator state, as someone, as something that is overstepping all understanding of China's authority, China's sovereignty. He was much ballyhooed, he was much pummeled for that, and he wasn't removed from his post, and politics continued as usual. Now, Gordon, a year later or 12 months later, he's being rewarded for saying the same thing. What's happened?
I think what's happened is that there's been a fundamental shift in people's thinking about China. If you go back a year ago, there were people like us who were very concerned about China, and there were others who thought China would gradually integrate into the international community, could be a partner for the United States, would help us solve problems. Well, a year later, in other words, now, I think in Washington, that conversation is over. Everyone is now very, very concerned about China. The only issue left really is, what do you do about the Chinese? And there's a great divide about that in Washington. But nonetheless, this perception of China has shifted immeasurably. And right now, people who think the Chinese are going to be helpful and being partners, you can number them on your left hand.
The quote from Captain Fennell, China is, quote, taking control of maritime areas that have never before been administered or controlled in the last 5,000 years by any regime called China. The People's Republic is not doing it in an area up to 900 miles from the mainland. They're doing it as close as dozens of miles off the coast of other nations. He's talking about the Philippines, of course, but we're looking to the possibility of conflict in South Korea because of the ADIZ and conflict in Vietnam and Australia. Now, this is something we've talked about for so long. I get out of time, Gordon, because I spend a deal of time trying to understand the issues you bring. And then every once in a while, I remind myself, well, Gordon Chang is not the United States Navy, so I shouldn't fault the United States Navy because they're not ahead of this. But have they caught up with Chang and made Chang a moderate here?
Well, you know, I think that they have shifted their views. I mean, now naval officers are concerned because they see what the Chinese are doing. You know, just last week, for instance, Chinese ships sailed through Indonesian islands. And the reason why
Saw that little tour down towards Australia, yeah.
And the reason why this is important, John, is because China has never said to Jakarta, we do not claim the Natuna Islands. The Natunas are just off the coast of the main Indonesian islands. They're thousands of miles away from what everyone else recognizes as China. And yet Beijing cannot disclaim the Natunas. And this means, you know, you've now got Chinese ships sailing through Indonesia, and they've got claims on Indonesian islands.
Earlier, we spoke to a correspondent about the Tonga Islands, which I didn't know existed, the Kingdom of Tonga Islands, that are several hundred miles, they're 100 miles or so to the east of the Fiji Islands and looks like about several thousand miles to the east of the Australian mainland. The Tonga Islands, where there's no product, there's subsistence agriculture and has a kingdom, and it's a member of the United Nations, but there's nothing there. And we learned that the Chinese are putting in small businesses and perhaps and contributing to the deterioration of security and civic affairs. But at the same time, there's a deep water port there. And if I were feeling that the Chinese were aggressors, I would say, Are they picking off anything that's not claimed? Is that what they're up to?
Well, here they don't have a claim to Tonga, but what they are trying to do is to dominate Tongan society. And they've been very successful, at least up to now, because there's been this wave of Chinese investment. You see all sorts of relations between the Tongans and the Chinese, which we didn't see 5-6 years ago. And, you know, Australia, which traditionally has exercised a lot of influence in the area, New Zealand, the United States, are now on the back foot.
There are a lot of islands in the Micronesia-Indonesia chain that aren't especially claimed, Gordon. If the Chinese show up, does that mean they plant a flag?
Well, you know, they're going to plant a flag as close to Hawaii as they can get. You know, if we didn't claim Midway, they'd be there tomorrow.
Gordon Chang of Forbes.com. Risk, the Chinese economy, and then there are those warships flying the Chinese Communist Party flag, sailing around islands that are available. I'm John Batchelor. This is The John Batchelor Show. I'm John Batchelor. Gordon Chang of Forbes.com is here. The executive director of Committee for Human Rights in North Korea, Greg Scarlatu, joins us now because this last week has been momentous and tragic at the same time. A new report with graphics, drawings, which were made by human beings witnessing the sadism and the mass murder of other human beings, not in the 1930s, not even in the 1970s in Cambodia, but right now, probably right now underway in North Korea. Greg, a very good morning to you. This was not news to you. However, the drawings made it impossible to turn away. Will something change from this? And I want to be optimistic, Greg. Good morning.
Good evening, John. Certainly something will change. 15 years ago, we still had deniers. We still had those who denied the existence of the North Korean political prison camps. Of course, unfortunately, we still have Holocaust deniers to this day. Now we have a clear determination made beyond any reasonable doubt by a UN body that crimes against humanity have been committed by the Kim regime and continue to be committed under the regime of Kim Jong-un.
And Greg, what's really important here is that this UN commission also talked about China, because China has been forcing back refugees to North Korea and has said that this is possibly aiding and abetting crimes of humanity. This is 2-3 years ago, this would have been unheard of, a UN body citing China in a situation like this.
This is the first time this is happening, and China used to be mentioned as a third country. This is the first time that it's called by name, and certainly the Commission has also recommended that the UN Security Council submit the North Korean case to the International Criminal Court. Of course, that's not going to happen over the short to medium term because of Chinese opposition. However, the price of unconditionally supporting a regime that has been found guilty of having committed crimes against humanity is going to be high. That position, over the long run, will turn out to be untenable.
What do you want to happen right away, Greg?
Right away, we would like to see NGOs such as the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea building on the findings and recommendations of the Commission, reaching out to governments, international regional organizations, civil societies, other NGOs, to build international momentum on a par with what was done in the 1980s to do away with South Africa's apartheid. We shouldn't shy away from condemning the North Korean system as a system which is in the post-communist, post-industrial, kleptocratic phase of this dynastic regime of the Kim family. Ideally, We would like to see a case being brought to the International Criminal Court realistically. That is very difficult over the short to medium term. I have one very interesting example, that of the country of Botswana, that decided yesterday to sever diplomatic relations with North Korea because the Commission of Inquiry has determined that crimes against humanity have been committed by that regime.
The investigators linked the persecution, the sadism, to state security, the Ministry of People's Security, the Army, the Judiciary, but importantly, the Workers' Party of Korea, all directly linked to Kim Jong-un. Does that mean, Gordon, they move against Kim Jong-un? They move to detain him or indict him?
Well, clearly the chairman of the commission sent a letter to Kim Jong-un and said that he possibly may be guilty of crimes against humanity because hundreds in his government were, and that it was just impossible for him not to know about these over the course of years. So, yes, Kim Jong-un is certainly on the hot seat because of this, as he should be, because he is the one who is directing a totalitarian regime. He has to know what's going on. He is directing this.
Greg, let's back up the SUV over a couple of instances we've had over these last months. The visits in Pyongyang, not just of a basketball star who has relented and perhaps was under the influence of chemical dependency, I don't know, but a leading American industrialist traveled to Pyongyang. Do I remember that correctly, Greg? The man is identified with Google. What was he doing with Kim Jong-un? What is anybody doing being celebrity tourisms in Pyongyang?
It's very ironic that Kim Jong-un never met with the CEO of one of the most successful enterprises on the planet, Eric Schmidt, CEO of Google, but instead he found the time to meet with Dennis Rodman on three separate occasions. This tells me that the regime of Kim Jong-un is absolutely hopeless. I do not see any hope for reform, for openness, for taking a turn in the positive direction. Young Kim Jong-un has simply continued the legacy of his father and grandfather. He's clearly playing by his father's playbook, and he has taken the brutality of the Kim regime to new heights to the extent that he has had his own uncle, a member of the core of the Kim family, right, executed in December.
Greg, we only have a few seconds, but the United States is talking to North Korea, or has been talking to North Korea, about its nuclear weapons program. Should we continue to do that with a person who has been responsible for crimes against humanity?
That certainly makes it more difficult to have the North Koreans sitting across the table as a negotiating counterpart. If it's the same old game, there's nothing to be gained. If the North Koreans will again ask for the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, which is code for suspending U.S.-South Korean joint military exercises, which is code for driving a wedge between the United States and Korea, and ultimately ensuring the withdrawal of U.S. troops from South Korea, that is not the way to go. So they would have to get very serious about taking real steps in the direction of denuclearization. That is very unlikely. Nuclear weapons are part of the very identity of the Kim regime. The Kim regime regards nuclear weapons as essential to fulfilling its main strategic objective, which is the very preservation of the regime.
Greg Scarlato, Executive Director of Committee for Human Rights in North Korea. Gordon Chang of Forbes.com. I'm John Batchelor. John Batchelor, Gordon Chang of Forbes.com is here. We're off to the Pacific, the whole of the Pacific, because we're looking at trade for the 21st century. This is a story that was distorted and used as what you'd have to say naked nationalism in the last presidential contest. So we're going to begin again with the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Free trade is a wonderful idea. It's embraced in general. But when you get to specifics, what does it mean? And what does it mean to the American workforce, to the American electorate? Gordon, what is the Trans-Pacific Partnership?
The Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, is a free trade deal involving the United States and about a dozen other nations rimming the Pacific. It is really meant to be a high-quality trade deal, a very, very important trading bloc when you consider who's involved. So, for instance, you'd have Japan very much wanting to be a part of it, Malaysia, a number of Latin American countries. And this is really meant to be part of the pivot because President Obama announced it in November of 2011 when he started talking about the rebalancing to Asia. So this is really the most important thing that we're doing in Asia at the moment.
We welcome David Feith, who writes for the Wall Street Journal, a columnist. He is in Hong Kong this morning, and recently David posted on the Wall Street Journal site a column about Trans-Pacific Partnership, especially about Taipei, Taiwan. And I want to go to Taiwan, but to begin in general with David's opinion from his sources in Asia. David, a very good morning to you. Recently, there were a series of incidents, staged or not, between leading members of the Democratic Party, including the president and the majority leader, where the question of the TPP came under a dark light. What is the opinion in Asia right now? Does Asia think the U.S. supports TPP or has turned against it? Good morning, David.
Good morning to you. Folks in Asia very much want this trade deal and are bothered at the moment by what appears to be Washington's unwillingness to really push forward on it. There's a lot of nervousness in general that, for example, the Democrats in Washington will not pursue the trade deal or not pursue the congressional authority needed to make the trade deal happen either at all or at a minimum not before the November election. And that's a harmful thing when you have very complex negotiations and you have other countries that have their own domestic concerns, especially Japan, for example. And when Washington does not appear stalwart and when it appears that things that are negotiated in Asia might be unraveled on Capitol Hill, it puts a real strain on the entire process.
Well, David, what's really important is, you know, you look back when a major trade deal has come before Congress, they've almost always gone through. So you had the North American Free Trade Deal, NAFTA, and in the Obama administration, you had the free trade agreement with South Korea with very important strategic implications. When push comes to shove, these things get through Congress. Is there a feeling in Asia that when push comes to shove on the Trans-Pacific Partnership that it will get through? Maybe not before the midterm elections this year, but eventually it'll come through? Or is there just real concern that it might not ever see the light of day in Washington?
I think there's a fair amount of confidence or hope that when push comes to shove, this will happen. But, of course, the timetable for that is uncertain. Having something slip till, let's say, December of this year during the lame duck session would be one thing, but once you're talking about further years ahead, it becomes a very difficult thing. To return again to Japan. Japan is the third largest economy in the world. It's the second largest economy in the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations, and it's probably the economy where this deal could have the most positive effect on economic growth at home and consumers overseas. In Japan, the window for getting this done is not going to be open forever. Shinzo Abe is the prime minister, is right now at an unusual moment of popularity and forward-leaning policy development. That's not going to last forever in Tokyo. And so once you talk about pushing it, let's say, at least to December or until next year or the following year, you really risk undermining some of the main benefits or the main things that might keep this together and make it valuable.
I learned from your column, David, that Taiwan is not now participating in the TPP talks, even though there's irony here, they're not going anywhere. Does Taiwan want to join TPP? And is that a credible ambition given China's looming presence?
Yes, and Taiwan wants to join And Taiwan's interest in joining is a very good symbol of the positive force for liberalization that TPP has already been and would be if it actually progresses from here. In Taiwan, it's an export-led economy. They've always taken trade seriously, but they've not done it in a way that is particularly focused on high-quality free trade deals or on the cutting of red tape at home. The Taiwanese economy is still very heavily regulated and not that open to high-quality trade with several other countries. So TPP is a major opportunity to reform the Taiwanese economy and trade system. And the real significance of that, even beyond this half-trillion-dollar economy of 23 million people, is geostrategic, which is that right now Taiwan is increasingly dependent on trade with China and therefore vulnerable to not only economic downturns in China, but if relations between China and Taiwan return to the tension and difficulty and threats of war that they've seen in the past, then China would be in the position to push boycotts and things that could harm Taiwan gravely. So for Taiwan, readjusting their trade balance and making more open trade with Japan, with the U.S., with Australia, and others is a matter of real, not just economic security, but national security.
And that's what makes TPP so important. This is not just another trade deal. This is trying to cement the Asian region to the United States and the United States to the Asian region. I can't think of anything more important that the Obama administration has attempted. And what is really depressing is that throughout these negotiations with the other countries in the TPP, the Obama administration has not been keeping Congress informed, and that has eroded support for TPP and Trade Promotion Authority on the Hill. And this is really important for us.
David, a concern I have here for Taipei is that it is blocked from all significant world organizations by the Chinese. Have the Chinese tipped their hand about TPP and Taiwan? Does President Ma have an insider relationship with China that makes that credible that they could join?
It's a very interesting and important question. The short answer is that for now, China is approaching Taiwan more with honey than vinegar. And so it is, for example, allowed Taiwan in the past year to sign its first ever trade agreement with non-diplomatic allies. So Taiwan at this point is down to very few official diplomatic allies. I think the number is something like 15, and the largest one of them is the African country of Burkina Faso. But Taiwan is a member of the World Trade Organization, and as such, last year, with China's tacit blessing, it signed trade deals with New Zealand and with Singapore, both of which don't have diplomatic relations with Taiwan. They have official relations with Beijing, but the Chinese stepped aside and allowed this to happen as part of a broader economic kind of rapprochement that's gone on between China and Taiwan over the past several years. That's another thing that might not last forever in East Asia. It's another thing, therefore, that makes TPP all the more urgent and important.
Gordon, I want to be suspicious here. Is anything about the strength of TPP in Taiwan, would that have upset the political speakers in Washington, or are they just disconnected from all of what's going on in Asia? They just regard it as local union boosting because they're looking for the polls.
Yeah, I think right now that Asia does not really figure too high on the priorities of most people in Washington. Really what you're seeing right now is a lot of local politics on TPP, mm-hmm. not very much discussion of strategic implications. When we're thinking about what China is doing, and people in Washington have not connected trade with security, and this to me is just unfathomable.
But David makes a very firm point that the TPP is the sort of protocol that would allow Taiwan and China to work together without conflict.
Well, you know, that sounds nice, but, you know, Taipei in, for instance, the World Trade Organization, has really been shunted aside by China in ways which are not justified by the agreement. So, you know, I'm not so sure that Beijing's attitudes towards Taiwan in TPP are going to stay benign for very long.
Final question on this, David, because you spoke with your Taiwanese sources on this. Do they believe the TPP is their road to integrate into the rest of the Pacific, not to, with China, but with trading partners on this side of the ocean?
Very much so. The Taiwanese president, Ma Ying-jeou, recently appointed a point man to lead the reforms that Taiwan would need in order to join the deal. That point man is a former vice president of Taiwan. That point man, Vincent Hsu, was in Washington at the Brookings Institution in November and gave a stem winder of a speech, if you can call a trade policy speech a stem winder, on how TPP is the thing that Taiwan needs to rebalance its economic relations and to integrate with America and the broader Pacific Rim. So they feel this very much. It's a bit of a latter-day thought of the past few months, but it's very much worth taking advantage of.
David Feith writes for the Wall Street Journal. He's a columnist based in Hong Kong. We're looking at the Trans-Pacific Partnership, not this year. Let's be practical here. The majority leader of the United States Senate opposes TPP. Not until there is a new majority leader can we take this conversation seriously. Gordon Chang of Forbes.com. If, of course, if. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor. Gordon Chang, Forbes.com, is here with me. We're off to Hong Kong. Joseph Sternberg, the business editor of the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal, joins. There's a new piece up on your websites right now by Carl Walter and Fraser Howie, who's often a guest with us, pointing to the Chinese stock market. What's wrong and why? Joseph, a very good morning to you. It calls itself a stock market, but it is suspicious. It doesn't permit IPOs. What is that, Joe? Good morning to you.
Hi, John. Well, this is another of these really interesting stories we've been talking about Beijing's attempt to reform their economy and be a little more market-oriented. And the story that Fraser and his co-author Carl Walter are talking about this morning is that, you know, for all of last year, 2013, and even a couple months before that, a total of 14 months, there were no IPOs in China. It became a big mystery out here. People were wondering why regulators weren't allowing new listings to come onto the market. And the best theory was that it was because they had become concerned about the lack of control that regulators had over moves in the market. They were worried about too much volatility, especially related to new listings. And so they had shut down that pipeline. Well, it's reopened this year. There were a bunch of new listings in January, but it's come with all of these new controls, such as a restriction on the percentage price increase that you can have on the first day, and even ongoing restrictions in the percentage price movement you can have on any trading day for a stock. And so I think that what's happening is that they are trying to find ways where they can have a stock market, have IPOs, but still maintain a high degree of regulatory control. And you have to start asking, well, if they're going to do it that way, what's the point of having a stock market?
Well, that's a great question, because these stock markets in China have been around since 1991, and they're still not functioning like stock markets. I mean, they look modern. I mean, they look incredibly modern, more modern than anything that we've got, and yet they're not working. And that's really, I think, an important story here, and that is that we often look at China and say, oh, my gosh, you know, what a great place it is. But when we look behind the curtain, it just doesn't seem to add up.
Help me, Gordon. Middle Kingdom, bureaucracy for 5,000 years, everything very structured. I remember stories about how you took the civil service test, this is the 14th or 15th century, by sitting in a cubicle for days, rote memorization. All right. Masters of bureaucracy. They come to a stock market and they fail. What explains this? Is it the communist ideology? Is it the revolution? Is it poor recruiting? What?
Well, it's not poor recruiting because the people who run China's stock markets have degrees from the best universities in the world. Our best universities, best universities in Europe and Asia. Really what this is, as Joe points out, is this a need for control. You know, you have, for instance, a government that does not want to see investors lose too much money, so therefore they don't allow IPOs, because if you have IPOs, then it drains money from existing issues, and so people would lose money. That's completely unacceptable, so they have this IPO suspension for 14 months, as Joe points out. And yet, you know, they try to control it in so many different ways. It's just, you can't make this stuff up.
Joe, I don't think they get the capitalism thing. Do you, Joe? I mean, I'm really frustrated here. It looks like a capitalist state, but it isn't.
Yeah, and I mean, it's really important to put this in the broader context of the reforms that China's economy needs right now, because, of course, the reason a stock market is important is not so that traders on Wall Street or the city in London have something to do all day. What you actually need a stock market to do is to play an important role in moving capital around your economy and allocating capital efficiently from savers who have excess capital to entrepreneurial businesses that need it. And that really is why this story is so important in the Chinese context right now. In so many other respects, the capital market in China is not operating effectively. The banks have major problems and a long history of directing capital only to state-owned companies instead of entrepreneurial private companies. The stock market should be a way to help solve that problem, but only if regulators are willing to give up enough control to allow the market to start efficiently allocating capital to these entrepreneurial smaller companies, you know, the private sector companies that really should be fueling growth if they're serious about rebalancing the economy.
Well, Joe, you know, what's worse than having a stock market that doesn't work in China? Well, the answer is you have a stock market that works. Because if you have a stock market that works in China, it means that money is going to come out of the banking system and go into the stock market. And that would really be a disaster for Beijing. So essentially, you can't reform the stock markets unless you reform the banks. You can't reform the banks unless you reform the entire economy. And you can't reform the entire economy unless the Communist Party is willing to give up a measure of control over society. This is an unbroken link, and that's, I think, one of the reasons why we have columns like the one you wrote about the malfunctioning stock market.
Gordon, I want to press you on this. The controlling the IPO, they don't want people to lose money, so you can't go too high in a certain day, and you know, it's a number of days you can't go too low. That tells me that they do not understand growth or prosperity, or that growing the system is better for everyone. They believe that it's finite, that it has to be controlled from day to day, that they almost as if the people in charge of the stock market see it as a zero-sum game. They don't see it attached to a larger economy.
Well, you know, I think the people who actually regulate the stock market know better. They've been educated in the West. You know, they know as much or more than our regulators, but they're within the confines of a system that don't allow them to actually regulate properly. And when you have that system, then nothing is going to work. You can have the most modern technology, you can have the most beautiful stock market buildings, but it isn't going to actually operate the way that it should, as Joe points out.
Joseph, what I'm hearing here is that this means, by limiting the IPO, we'll just focus on that, this means that they're not actually permitting new companies to form, and capital formation is the tool that the investor class uses to pour money in. That attracts money from overseas, and the Chinese are deliberately mutilating their system for control. That means their future is automatically delimited. Correct, Joe?
Right, and I mean, don't miss out on a lot of the knock-on consequences of this 14-month IPO ban that they had in effect. I mean, we were hearing a lot of stories about how private equity or venture capital investors, both within China and overseas, were becoming more and more reluctant to invest in those much smaller Chinese companies, the very entrepreneurial new startups that would, you know, wouldn't have been ready for a listing yet. But, you know, if those those PE investors are going to come in and help develop that company, they expect to be able to do an IPO later as a way of cashing in
their
investment.
That's when you bring in innovation, Gordon, because people can start a company and the investors will show up and invest in it. That means they're just going to imitate and copy and steal. They're not going to create.
Absolutely, John. This is Economics 101.
Joseph, has this been... All right. Joseph Sternberg of the Asia Wall Street Journal. I'm John Batchelor.